Well, to kick us off, I'm going to answer the question that I'm sure a lot of you are curious about. I got Ohio State tomorrow, all right? They're going to win national championship. I firmly believe it. I also don't have a lot of, options in this, all right? I didn't grow up Catholic, and my whole family's from Ohio, so go Buckeyes, all right? This is the most important thing I felt like we could start today with, and then I figured we'll talk about Jesus. So in a as a result of that, we are going to continue today in our series on the book of Colossians, where we wanted to kick this year off by looking at one of Paul's letters, because Paul's letters give us such a great framing of how it is that we can live a faithful life, and who Jesus was for the world and who Jesus continues to be for us today. And he ended up sending this letter to this church in Colossae. And the entire purpose of this was to be read by the whole community in order for everybody to get instruction on this renowned church leader's understanding of how it is that we can live a faithful life. And last week we talked about kind of how does the structure of a letter work? What are the pieces and the elements? And we looked at like the introduction section. And today we're gonna talk about like the initial blessing that he gives over the church of Colossae, over these Colossians and the things that they're going through. And he kicks off if we pick back up exactly where we left off last week, picking back up in Colossians 1. And in, Paul says, in the same way, the gospel is bearing fruit and growing throughout the whole world, just as it has done among you since the day you heard it and truly understood God's grace. You learn from Epaphras, our dear fellow servant, who is a faithful minister of Christ on our behalf, and who also told us of your love in the Spirit. Now, this is particularly funny the way that he's framing this, because Epaphras actually kind of snitched on the church of Colossae, because he was the one who ended up going to visit Paul in prison and is like, hey, you got to help me course correct these people, because they've completely gone off of all the teachings of who Jesus is. And so Paul ends up deciding to write this letter in hopes of helping them understand that they can't continue to do the things they've always done. Because what's happened is that this church of the Colossians, they have held on to their belief in these Greek mythological religious figures and trying to hold up Jesus a part of it. And so it's almost like they just wanted to shove Jesus into this Greek pantheon so that he could hang out with like Zeus and Athena and all these other ones. And Paul's entire premise is like, no, like it doesn't work like that. You have to understand that there is a singular unified way that we all have to worship and live faithfully for Christ. And I say that phrase, and I know that that's like a weird, complicated thing, just in the sense of like, in a modern day sense, like there are so many different denominations, so many different ways that people faithfully follow Jesus. But the reality is, back then, there really was only one way. And this was for a few reasons. Back in the day, for about the first 300 years or so of the Christian church, there really was no genuine debates or conversations around the theology of who Jesus was. Everybody had the same general idea of how it is that they were going to live faithfully. It actually wasn't until Emperor Augustine, back in about 300 or so A.D., ended up converting himself to Christianity, and then what he did is he ended up making a passing legislation that ended up giving protection to all those who were Christians within the Roman Empire. And then that gave them protection throughout the whole world. But up until that point, like it was like a startup company basically, where they were like, listen, we all gotta be unified, we all gotta be together, because if we're fighting with each other, then we have no hope of surviving when everybody else is gonna fight with us from the outside. So that is how they lived for the first 300 years, this very unified vision of how it is that they could live faithfully, all having the same mind and giving up all of the same things. And after the first 300 years or so, then they started to have these conversations, because right after that legislation was passed, ended up having the first major council of the Christian church. This was called the Council of Nicaea. The Council of Nicaea happened in about 323 A.D., and, depending on who you talk to, there's a few different perspectives on the notable things that came out of the Council of Nicaea. Like, if you talk to, most religious scholars and theologians, they're going to tell you that the most notable thing that came out of the Council of Nicaea was this unified creed known as the Nicene Creed, which gave us language and verbiage that we could all point to as the things that unified us in Christ. That is what most scholars and theologians will tell you is the most notable thing to come out of the council. I am not most notable, most scholars and theologians. I believe the most notable thing to happen in the Council of Nicaea is that St. Nicholas punched a dude in the face. And by that, the same St. Nicholas, the one you're thinking of, he was at the Council of Nicaea, right? And there was this guy who got up and he started spouting off all these heresies. And like St. Nicholas, like he can't hold it in. He just gets up and he's like, listen, I came here to give presents away and punch dudes in the face and I'm all out of presents. Let's go. And he just like clocks a guy and he ends up getting like kicked out of his leadership position from the church. But it's fantastic. It's my favorite story that it came from the Council of Nicaea. And I'm so grateful. I'm so thankful that we had those early church historians who were making sure that like we didn't end up falling into these heresies, that we held true to like the important things of Christ. And that's why actually the work of Paul was so critical for the 300 years leading up to it, because Paul in his ministry and his letters was giving a foundation that allowed for that council to be a much more effective thing. Because Paul's perspective was, listen, we all have to live in the same way. We can't live in the ways that we used to. Because what Paul understood was that the gospel's the design of the gospel wasn't for things to be informative. The purpose of Jesus was not to be informative. The purpose of Jesus, the purpose of the gospel, was to be transformative. It was for us to have a new heart that was different from the heart that we had always had. And that, in fact, the argument is like, if you're not going to change who you are, then honestly, this is kind of a waste of time. And it's the same kind of perspective. Like, even to this day, like, if you and I are not willing to change ourselves to live more faithfully for Christ, bluntly, there's, like, better things we could be doing on a Sunday morning. But if we believe that we can change, if we believe we want to change, then this is the only important thing that we could be doing on a Sunday morning. And it extends beyond that. Like, it can't just be for us here on Sunday morning. Like, we have to take it with us throughout the week. And we can't hold on to the things we've always held on to. Like, the Colossians could not continue to hold on to the Greek gods and the Greek beliefs in order to be faithful followers of Christ, because what kind of message would that send? This is like when Planet Fitness had this whole thing, and they decided they wanted to like reward people for having like a good workout. And so what they would do is they would like give away donuts and pizza as you were leaving from the gym. And like, what kind of message does that send? It's like, hey, this was really great work here. Now go do whatever you want. Like, you've earned it, right? Like, that can't be how we live faithfully in the church as well. And so this is the challenge for us is are we willing to give up gossiping? Are we willing to give up anger and hostility? Are we willing to give up the grudges that we've held against others? Are we willing to give up our pride? Are we willing to give up our arrogance? Are we willing to give up our greed? Are we willing to give up our vices? Are we willing to give up all the things that hold our life back from the image of Christ? Or do we care so deeply about those that we can't fully grasp what Christ has offered? Because each one of those fly in the face of the life that we have been promised. Each one of those fly in the face of what could be. And the hardest thing for us is to just embrace genuine motivation. The hardest thing for us is to genuinely accept the fact that we want a different life than what we've always had. The question is, how do we get the motivation we need to become that person? And this is bluntly where I'm less than thankful, honestly, for the way that church has operated for hundreds of years. Because for hundreds of years, the way that the church has operated is that there have been a lot of places in which we have used fear and shame as a way to motivate. Right? This is the whole fire and brimstone thing. It's the whole, like, listen, if you don't stop gossiping, if you don't give up those vices, like, you are going to suffer for all eternity, all right? And, like, it's just damnation. It's just fear-mongering. And for some, it worked really, really well. For some, it inspired people to want to completely change how they lived. But the reality is that it motivated a far smaller percentage than it dissuaded and scared and pushed away. And what ended up happening is that those individuals who were motivated in that way became loud voices, and so we began to double down on that and double down on that. Things became more and more hostile and negative of, you have to give up this, you have to give up this, lest you end up suffering for all of eternity. And the truth is that all the research shows that if you want to truly be motivated, that you can't focus on fear, you can't focus on shame, you can't focus on threats. Despite the fact that that's how we believe we're going to be motivated. It's why platitudes don't end up actually holding with us, right? Like, it's, you know, going back to the Planet Fitness model, one of the things that people have loved to tell me at times when I'm like, listen, I'd love to work out a little bit more. And they're like, well, listen, you know, you just got to remember, nothing tastes as good as skinny feels. And I'm like, first of all, that's not true, all right? You ever been the whiskey cake? That tastes pretty dang great, all right? And in that way, like, those platitudes, like, the argument is like, listen, you wanna have this, and you need to be afraid that what that tastes like is gonna be better than how this feels. And instead, what we need to focus on is like, listen, don't you actually want that life instead? Don't you actually want the long-term benefits instead? Because the reality is that the way that Jesus presented the gospel, the way that the early church gospel spread, wasn't through those threats, wasn't through that fear, wasn't through that shame. The way the early church gospel spread was by promising the hope and the goodness of the kingdom of heaven. Yeah, logically speaking, if you don't get heaven, you know, you're going to get the other side. We get that. But Jesus' whole premise was far more what you could have. Paul's premise was far more what you have been promised. And in fact, if we embrace that and see that as the lens of what we're chasing after, that's how we're actually going to end up feeling the motivation to live the life that we truly want to live. And this is what Paul ends up doing as he continues in this passage. I'm going to bounce around a little bit, but the very end of this passage, he's going to say, for he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption for the forgiveness of sins. See, it's the promise of the rescue. Yeah, there's the dominion of darkness and blah, 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 but it's the promise of the rescue. It's the promise for redemption. It's the promise for the forgiveness of sins, focusing on all the goodness that lies in front of us if we're willing to let go of the old. We'll go back to the beginning where he says, so it says this as he continues. He goes, for this reason, since the day we heard about you, we have not stopped praying for you. We continually ask God to fill you with the knowledge of his will through all the wisdom and the understanding that the Spirit gives, so that you may live a life worthy of the Lord and please him in every way, bearing fruit in every good work, growing in the knowledge of God, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, so that you may have great endurance and patience, and giving joyful thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of his holy people in the kingdom of light. For he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sin. This is how Paul outlines how it is that we need to live faithfully. The motivation and the action before it. When you hear that action to bear fruit, when you hear that action to grow in our knowledge and our understanding of God, you hear that action to give joyful thanks to the Lord. It's funny because you hear those things and honestly, they feel a little cliche. Like, they feel a little cliche because of the things that we've been spouting off for 2,000 years, all right? This is how apparently Gen Z doesn't like Seinfeld. It's a whole weird thing I've learned. Gen Z doesn't like Seinfeld because, like, they watch the show and they feel like all the jokes that are being made are just, like, old, weaker forms of jokes that they now love. And the irony is that, like, no, it's because Seinfeld was the first one to actually lay it down, and we've been building upon it ever since. And in that same way, we hear things like, well, just bear fruit of the Spirit. Give joyful thanks to God. This is the way for us to truly live faithfully. And you're like, there's got to be more to it. And you're like, no. Everything else is just built upon that very premise. That if we have faithfully given ourselves to God, that these are the things that we are going to do, and they're just going to take various forms and manners. But the truth is that you've got to do them. I love the way that Paul frames this, because he talks about how, like, listen, yeah, the Spirit of God has been upon you. You guys have become a faithful church of Jesus Christ. And now you should know that my prayer for you is that you continue to grow in your love of God. You continue to grow in your knowledge of God and the knowledge of what Christ has done. You continue to grow by giving faithful, joyful thanks to who God is. And I love this juxtaposition, because it emphasizes the importance of the fact that, like, yes, there's these moments where we're going to give ourselves over to Christ, but it cannot stop there. This idea that we can just be like, yeah, I love Jesus and that's enough, it doesn't even jive with how Paul described it. That's a great first step. You want to love Jesus. Perfect. Now you have to actually move on in your growth. John Wesley, who kind of started the Wesleyan movement, Methodist understanding of theology, he described it in this way. He said that, like, there are multiple points in our own salvation. One of them is the point of justification, the point at which we're justified in Christ, the point at which we have unified ourselves with Christ. And that is an incredible moment. And from that moment, we then have to grow. From that moment, we then have to become a deeper, richer, fuller version of ourselves. And he called this sanctification. The best analogy for this is, like, you know, justification is the point at which you actually buy a house, right? You get the keys. It's amazing. You take the picture. You go to the title office, sign way too many documents that you don't read, all right? And then you go over here, and now you actually live in the house. And none of us live in that house and do no work on it for the rest of our lives. It's an incredible moment. It's an incredible thing. And yet, each and every one of us know there's work to be done. There's things to be cleaned. There's things to be fixed. There's renovations that need to occur. Even if something that we once loved no longer actually feels correct, now we need to strip it out and make it good again. And when we embrace that, it allows us to actually look back at that house at every stage and find goodness, even in the things that were difficult. Even in the things we had to fix, we find fondness in them. And the importance for that analogy is because there are going to be moments where we are going to be frustrated. There's going to be moments in which, like, we're really upset with the house. There's going to be moments where we don't want to have to put in the work to do for the house. There's going to be moments where we would rather do literally anything else but a chore, anything else but a project. And yet, we know the thing that we need to do. And so when life and this world start to beat us down, the question is whether or not we're willing to find the joy of the house. This is why I love a Nike slogan, right? So, like, Nike's slogan is obviously "Just Do It." All right, it's one of the most iconic phrases in human history, as far as marketing is concerned. And the reason I love this phrase is not because it tells us to do something. I don't believe that the most powerful word in that three-word phrase is "do." I think the actual most powerful word in it is "just." Because there's a moment when every athlete gets to a point where they go, I don't have it in me today. And Nike looks at them and tells them, just do it. Just do it anyway. There's a moment at which we go, I don't have the motivation. There's a moment at which we go, I don't feel like it's going to be worthwhile. And we have to remind ourselves to just go do it, knowing that when we commit to it, goodness comes. Even when we don't want to fold laundry, we know it's a better feeling when we get on the other side of it. I'm doing laundry right now, so that one hit a little close to home, all right? There's moments that we don't want to do the work, but we have to. And for me, this is actually why understanding where we're going, but actually understanding where we've been, is the right way to understand how to give thanks to God. Because where we're going is phenomenal. The kingdom of heaven, I love that. But it's moments where we lose sight of that, and it's hard to imagine all the work being done. It's hard to imagine that it's actually going to be worthwhile. And that's when we have to actually look to the things that we can give thanks for, the things that have come before this moment. Because when we give thanks to them, we find true joy. And so what we're going to do is we're going to actually do an exercise. I want everybody to pull out their phones. If you have a pen and paper, good for you. But like, I haven't had a pen on me in forever because I just lose them or I wash them in the washing machine and I got a whole new problem. All right. What I'm going to do is I want you to pull out your phone. And what I want you to do is we're going to spend about 1 to 2 minutes. Daniel's going to play some good music for us. He's going to pad. But what I want you guys to do is I want you guys to list any good things that have ever happened in your past. And I need you to note that there are no rules around this. If it is something that brings a smile to your face, it is something that brings some fondness to you, if it is something that you can look back on and find joy in, you can write it down. There are no rules except that you cannot go into the future. And we're going to go for about 2 minutes, and I want you to see how many things you can write down in the next 2 minutes. Goes by fast. I wrote down the day that my wife and I got married, the day that my son was born. I wrote down the first time that I went skiing. I wrote down the first time I had whiskey cake. I wrote down the Lego Baby Yoda that sits in my office. I wrote down the time that we bought our house. Because what I can point to is how each and every one of those moments actually was a moment that God was blessing and doing goodness in. The first time I went to Whiskey Cake, it was with my small group here from St. Andrew. The first time I went skiing was because I volunteered with the student ministry for the first time. The first time I ever built a Lego set as an adult was this Baby Yoda that sits in my office, and it was this incredible moment where my wife was like, hey, I think this would be a great thing for you, and my hope is that maybe one day you can do this with our son. Each and every one of these moments that brings joy to me are things that God has ordained for goodness in this world to draw me closer to the community of Christ and away from the brokenness of this world. And here's the beautiful thing that has happened. As I've been talking, you've been sitting there going, oh, shoot, I wish I had written such and such thing down. And you can. What I want you to do for the rest of this week is I want you to continue to write down things as they come to you that are bringing you joy. Because what you're going to find is that's not the things that we hold on to. It's not our vices. It's not our arrogance. It's not social media. It's not gossip. It's not anger. It's not hostility. It's not grudges. No one of those things has ever brought a genuine sense of joy. But in fact, all the things that have brought us fulfillment have been the things that Christ has been working us to see that we can have. And in those moments where we don't have the motivation, in those moments where we go, I don't want to put in the work, may we pull up that note and look and go, oh, that's right. When I commit to Christ, look at all the goodness that happens. And then maybe we can add to the list that day. Let's pray. gracious and loving God, you came into this world. You gave us so many reasons to give thanks. And in times we lose our sight on you, in times we lose our motivation, and God, I ask that you remind us of where motivation comes from. It comes from you and you alone. It comes from your Son. It comes from your Spirit. So as we go through this week, God, let the list grow of all the things we've done. And then God, let us be motivated to build that list even greater until we've let go of all the things that hold us back from you. It's in your name we pray.